Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 9. Seventh hole. Another par 3, but no sign of water on this hole. It didn't need it. The green was surrounded by sand traps, and the front was pushed in, giving it a kidney shape. Scott and Paul looked down, and Scott cringed at the pin placement. It was near the front right of the green. At 190 yards, it would be difficult to land a shot too close to the pin. Too short, and you were in the sand. If you hit it to the left and short, you had to hit over the indentation of the green. Most likely, the shots would be toward the middle or back of the green. Few would birdie this one today. Paul checked the wind and handed Scott his 5-iron. Scott nodded in agreement.
"Mr. Hanover still has honors," droned the official, as if tired of the phrase.
"Straight for the pin?" asked Scott.
"A little left," answered Paul. "You've been fading your low irons a little."
He stepped back off the tee box, and the crowd assumed an eerie silence. Scott stood for a moment, looking at the green below him. Apart from the 13th hole on the back nine, also a par 3, this was one of the easier holes on the course. But the way they had placed the pin had made it much more challenging than some of the longer holes. If he could be sure to make it past the sand trap, he'd definitely get a par. Heck, just hitting the green would make him happy here. He once had heard a golf pro trying to explain to a commentator the difficulty of hitting on the green. He compared it to basketball. A golfer who was able to get his ball on the green in the regulation number of strokes was similar to a basketball player hitting a free throw from the half-court line. To get it within 6 feet of the pin, generally considered a doable one-putt distance, was like sinking the free throw without the ball touching the rim.
"What about a hole in one?" joked the commentator.
The pro laughed. "Well," he contemplated, "instead of half court, stand behind the opposite goal, throw it with your opposite hand while hopping on 1 foot blindfolded and still miss the rim. That's your chance of making a hole in one." Scott had never had a hole in one or even seen one in person. He'd seen a few on highlight tapes from golf tournaments and had chipped some in from 15 or 20 yards, but never for the elusive eagle. A score 2 under par. Much more difficult to obtain than 2 over par, he mused. He placed his ball on a tee and pushed the tee almost completely flush with the ground, then lined up the duck so that it was pointing a little to the left of the pin. He then drew his imaginary line behind the ball and stepped to the left side and lined up his feet parallel to that line. He turned his head and watched the flag barely rustle in the light breeze. He took his 2 practice swings and stepped up. The sudden, distinctive rumble of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle roared along 159th Street to his left, and he stepped back. He knew better than to swing when all he could think about was how he wouldn't let some noise bother him. Usually it bothered him more than he knew, and it was better to step back and start over.
Whenever you're ready, urged the official impatiently.
Scott ignored him, but did see Ellie with her camera, poised to capture his seventh tee shot. He took two more practice swings, the club barely brushing the grass. He moved his shoes forward and set them on the ground. If there were other sounds from the road, he didn't hear them. There was no roar of planes, nor putter of golf carts. He didn't even hear anyone breathing. He pulled back the club and let his wrists bend as they cocked in position to unload. He seemed to wait a fraction of a second longer than usual, but once his downswing started, there was no stopping it. The club hit the ball squarely, and a wooden thwack resounded from the trees. The ball soared high and straight, just to the left of the pin, but drifting closer as it neared. It was definitely not in danger of hitting the sand traps in front of the pin, but some extra power had seeped into his stroke. It looked like it might land behind the pin and perhaps roll off the back of the green, maybe into another sand trap. Scott sagged, disappointed in the shot, but he knew no matter what, it would still be a good round. The ball drifted closer to the pin, but it was obvious now to everyone that it would sail past it.
Stick,
Scott heard someone say, encouraging the ball in flight to stay on the green. Scott knew his shot lacked the backward spin pros could impart on their ball to have it roll back up the green towards the pin. He hoped it might stay on the green and he could thunk. The sound reached them a fraction of a second after the ball struck the flagstick dead on. It almost seemed to stick to the fiberglass pole for a moment before proceeding to drop straight to the ground, disappearing into the hole. It must have been trapped between the pole and the side of the hole, because with the speed it had, it should have popped right out.
Oh my God, muttered Scott.
He blinked and started breathing in short, heavy breaths.
It's in the hole, shouted Paul, breaking the silence. It's in the hole.
He stepped up to Scott, yelling the same thing over and over.
It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
The crowd around the hole was cheering and screaming and jumping and hugging each other. Ellie was getting it all on tape. She was starting to cry with happiness for Scott Hanover, but managed to keep the camera rolling. Nothing else she would see this day would match what she had just witnessed. It was pure luck the ball didn't fly past the flagstick and race off the back of the green into a sand trap. Pure, unadulterated luck. Even though she wasn't the one who hit the ball, she felt a wave of adrenaline race through her body. She didn't know this guy from Adam, but she was so happy for him she couldn't believe it. He was having the best round of golf she had ever seen. He had parred two holes, birdied four, and now an eagle. A hole in one. He was 6 under par after only 7 holes. She doubted Patterson would be doing that well after 18 holes. This was the guy to beat today. And soon the people at the scoreboard would know it. Jason Bernard would know it. And she had been there to witness it. Jerry and Pete took their turns congratulating Scott, both sincerely in awe of his amazing luck.
Well, that's not normally the way you get a hole in one, commented Jerry.
I'll take it any way I can get it, answered Scott. Jerry and Pete played the hole in the shadow of the shot. Both ended up with bogeys after landing in different sand traps. Scott was convinced he'd be with them, or worse, if that ball hadn't hit the stick just right.
Amazing, thought Scott. Amazing.
He could walk off the course now and be thrilled. But as he watched the score update, showing him 5 strokes ahead of the nearest competitor, a realization came over him. It was his tournament to lose now, and he was quite capable of fulfilling that prophecy. He glanced around the crowd that had continued to grow all morning. He wondered if any of them had come to the same realization. Right now, all they were thinking about was the fact that they were here to witness his amazing hole-in-one on 7.
It was pretty amazing,
he told himself. One in a million. Eric Peters was waiting by the ball machine at the driving range. His boss, Andrew Patterson, was walking down the sidewalk from the clubhouse, on his way to warm up. Eric checked his watch. Patterson was up in 20 minutes. He had given Eric instructions about his warm-up ahead of time so that he could perform his routine uninterrupted. Eric unzipped a side pocket on the golf bag and pulled out the expensive designer golf shoes in their plastic bag. He set them in front of a bench, laces untied and ready to put on. Patterson was a fairly easy man to caddy for once you got used to his eccentricities. He never asked for advice, and really only needed someone to carry his bag and hand him the next club. A roar erupted from the crowd by the scoreboard. People were jumping up and down, and Andrew Patterson turned his head disgustedly, as if they were commenting on his walking away from them. But they weren't, observed Eric. They were excited about something on the scoreboard. Andrew reached the practice range area and wordlessly put on his soft, spiked Pierre Cardins. As Patterson stood up, he noticed one of the other caddies racing down to the driving range area, looking like he was going to burst. Ignoring the overexcited youth, Andrew took his 5-iron from Eric's hand and started his stretching routine at the tee box. Eric had made sure the adjacent practice areas were empty and was worried that the caddy racing toward him was going to interrupt the boss's routine. He quickly reached them, but was too out of breath to speak.
"Keep it quiet," cautioned Eric. "Mr. Patterson needs a few minutes to get ready."
He rolled his eyes in Patterson's direction. The caddy's breath started coming back to him, and between huffs, he whispered to Eric,
"He got a hole in one."
Eric whispered back to confirm what he had heard.
"A hole in one? Hanover, 7th hole. Hit the pin and drop straight in." "Holy bejesus," gasped Eric.
"Eric," came a stern voice from the tee box. Eric walked over and lined up 5 balls, 3 inches apart along the AstroTurf mat, and stepped back as Patterson did his practice drill. Eric stepped back to ask another question.
"What's he shooting so far?"
The caddy was now recovering from his all-out sprint and answered quietly,
6 under.
"Oh my gosh," muttered Eric.
"That's amazing. They said they might have to change the pairings. He's like 5 strokes ahead of the rest of the field so far."
"Eric?" prompted Patterson once again. Eric resumed his duties.
"I'll catch you later," he said, dismissing the other caddy.
The boy walked along the practice area divulging the news to the others, who responded with gasps and utterances of amazement and awe.
"What was that about?" asked Patterson.
Eric thought that the question was out of character. He was slightly hesitant to reveal the news, but figured Patterson would hear about it soon enough.
Guy got a hole-in-one on the 7th hole."
"Lucky shot," concluded Andrew.
"Aren't all eagles?"
"Precisely. No room for luck in my game. Skill and planning win golf matches. After 18 holes, it'll catch up one way or another."
"What are you planning to shoot today?"
6 under. Why? What's the fellow have now?"
"Bobby says he's at 6 under after 7 holes.
Andrew stopped in mid-swing. He didn't turn to face Eric, but started his swing over. If this fellow was on the 7th hole, he had started earlier this morning and was one of the poorer players by handicap to enter the tournament. Still, handicaps rarely lied. This fellow would have his bad holes too, and end up being a footnote at the end of the day. Andrew had never hit a hole-in-one in his 2 years of the game, but had come within several inches of the cup a few times. His ace would come someday, perhaps more than one, but only with practice and attention to the details of the game. Luck was in the details, he thought, and luck worked both ways. Gina Beck swung her braced left leg with practiced ease out of her white Honda Civic, and then pulled herself out. Once standing, Her practiced gait would give little away of her disability. She looked around and saw Jake's Geo Metro. He was still there.
Thank God,
she sighed with relief. Her worst fear was allayed. She noticed a crowd gathered in front of the clubhouse and figured that it would be as good a place as any to start looking for Jake. She didn't fail to notice what a wonderful fall day it was turning out to be, and hoped she and Jake would get a chance to see some of the golfers. More than anything, though, she hoped he'd been able to get the player Jonathan had sent him for. She also hoped he would be happy to see her. She walked toward the clubhouse. A man at a table labeled Check-In asked if he could help her, but she smiled and walked on. Her smile almost had superpowers, and one of them was getting men to let her do what she wanted, most of the time. He shrugged and let her go, assuming she must know what she was doing. It was difficult to see if Jake was in the crowd. A mass of people was gathered near a large series of scoreboards, watching as an elderly man busily hung numbers under the various holes for each player as they were reported to him. Suddenly, she saw what everyone had been murmuring about. Posted under the seventh hole along the line of scores for Hanover S was a green card with the number 1 printed on it. A golfer had hit a hole in one. That would have been neat to see. The other two golfers on the hole had turned in fours, and she was duly impressed by Hanover's 6-under total score. She thought it was unusual that such a good golfer would be among the first groups teeing off, but who knew what the tournament officials were thinking.
"Forgive me," said a familiar voice in her left ear.
Gina turned. It was Jake. She smiled and gave him a hug and a kiss.
"Forgive you for what?" "For everything."
She looked into his eyes.
They were more alive than they had been in a year, clear and almost bright, shiny with early tears,
hopeful and apologetic.
"Are you okay?"
she asked tentatively.
"I am now." "Did you get that golfer? Jonathan called you?"
Gina nodded. Jake stepped back and sighed.
"I found him, but Karen Blakely got to him first."
"Oh, sweetie," she consoled.
"He's a jerk anyway. Not the kind of athlete I can handle well. I think it's for the best."
"Let's go. I'll buy you breakfast, and we can talk about it."
"You can buy me breakfast, but I'm not leaving."
"Why not?" Gina asked, intrigued by his response.
"Look at this guy, Hanover. He's on fire. I have a feeling he's going to be more of the type that Callaway wants."
"What does Jonathan say?"
"I haven't run it by him. I want to see how it plays out some more. Even if Callaway doesn't want him, maybe I can work a small deal with Second Swing or Nevada Bob's,"
he suggested, naming a few smaller golf chains that might not be able to afford the budget of a golf giant like Callaway, but would want to reach the weekend golfers with one of their own. Gina looked over at Jake, leaned in, and sniffed.
"I'm okay," he assured Gina.
"Oh, I know you haven't been drinking. You haven't talked like this since before London. But that jacket really needs a cleaning," she said, wrinkling her nose in disgust. Jake smiled. He shrugged off the jacket and pulled off his tie.
"This isn't me anyway. I was trying to be a little upscale for this Patterson fellow, but who can compete with Karen Blakely in a tight dress and heels?"
"Ahem," interjected Gina.
"Present company excluded, of course," corrected Jake.
"Jake," interrupted an excited voice, "help me out here. You know sports pretty well."
Jake turned and found himself looking at the sportscaster he had met earlier in the dining area, Jason Bernard.
"Pretty well," agreed Jake, hesitantly.
Jason was standing on the other side of Gina, half staring at the scoreboard.
"A hole-in-one is pretty rare, right?"
"Pretty rare,"
he parroted. "They usually make the news, don't they?"
"You bet."
"I gotta find my camera woman." Jason glanced at his watch. "Shoot, that Patterson guy is up soon," he said, fishing out his cell phone.
"Who's that?" whispered Gina, apparently not offended that the excited man had totally ignored her.
A sportscaster who hates golf. Well, maybe I should say hated golf. I guess he sees a chance to upstage the marathon coverage.
If this Hanover can win, it'll likely upstage the whole sportscast.
Very likely, agreed Jake. If he wins.
Gina grabbed Jake's arm and snuggled up close.
You're really okay. I was shaky a few times, I won't lie to you. I haven't seen you like this for a long time, Jake. It's good. I met a guy who's been here, Gina.
Really?
Yeah. I know just wanting to go doesn't mean much because I've promised you a lot in the last year and let you down every time.
Go where? Asked Gina.
After this is over, I'm going to find a meeting. Tonight.
A meeting? Asked Gina. Not sure, but hopeful she knew what he meant.
Gina. I'm going. Brad would be proud, she said. I know,
choked Jake. He hugged Gina, and they stood there for a while, silent. The crowd started to melt away, the moment of excitement fading, and life got a little better. Karen Blakely banged on the dashboard of her Mercedes convertible. Not only was she stuck in traffic, but April had ended up sending her on a wild goose chase. The radio was reporting that Eric Gunther had dropped out of the race, and preliminary tests were showing an adverse reaction to performance-enhancing medication, namely phenylephrine. Phenylephrine was found in common cold medications, and, as one gymnast found out in the Sydney Olympics, it was enough to disqualify her from competition, even though she just wanted to get rid of a stuffy nose. Gunther must have practically overdosed on the stuff, and his body couldn't handle the strain. If he lived, he'd probably not be allowed to race competitively again. Karen looked for an exit, but judging how the traffic was moving on the Dan Ryan, it would take her half an hour to travel 4 blocks. The marathon was tying up several overpasses, and people were trying to get on and off the expressway to get a look at some family member or friend, jogging themselves into early arthritis and several days of sore muscles. She glanced at her watch. Patterson would tee off in 20 minutes. It would take him 4.5 hours to play his round, so she'd definitely be back to watch him accept his trophy. But she wanted him to see her on the course, observe him, let him know that she was there for him. She also hoped to ensure he'd get footage on the sportscasts tonight, and that he was wearing a Callaway cap instead of that ridiculous tam she caught him in earlier. She could see an exit 100 yards ahead. The cars were barely moving. This was ridiculous. She checked her mirror, and the shoulder was empty. With a heavy foot, she slid out of her lane onto the shoulder and raced past the line of cars to the off-ramp. The flash of lights made her heart sink. Not a ticket, she thought. She slowed a little, and a short burst from the cruiser's siren encouraged her to stop. No problem, she thought. A sexy smile and a promise not to do it again had worked before. The officer in the state trooper car was typing on a little keyboard, running her plate. How ridiculous. The door opened and out stepped a woman. Karen's forehead hit the steering wheel. It was just not turning out to be her day. Ellie's cell phone buzzed in her pocket. She glanced at the display. It was Jason Bernard. The group following Scott Hanover was on their way to the 8th tee. She answered the phone.
Did you get it?
Asked an excited voice.
Mr. Bernard? She asked.
She hadn't been expecting excitement from him. Not today. Then she remembered her talk with her Uncle Harry.
The hole in one. Tell me you got tape, pleaded Jason.
It's in the can, she confirmed.
What happened?
His shot hit the flagstick and just dropped in. A 1 in a million shot.
Holy cow. When will you be in?
2 more holes. 30 minutes, maybe 40 minutes.
Patterson will be teeing off before then.
Forget Patterson, she said. This is the story.
He could fade. We have to have Patterson.
The hole in one is at least a story.
Absolutely,
agreed Jason.
but if he doesn't win the tournament, he's not the one people are going to focus on. Could he lose it?
Ellie thought about it. Half the great shots she'd seen Hanover make, including this one, were pure luck. The second hole was a total disaster until he chipped it in. The fourth was not far from the same. Not to mention the other two golfers turning in embarrassing holes to drop them out of contention. Yeah, she agreed reluctantly. He could lose it.
Then we get some Patterson and still follow him if Hanover doesn't bungle the last two holes in the front half.
Front nine, corrected Ellie.
Whatever. Listen, I'd like to do a quick edit when you get in so we can get the hole-in-one on the air. I think they'll run it before the 9 o'clock report. We have everything we need in the truck, right?
Right.
Great. Keep taping,
he instructed, and hung up. Like she needed that bit of advice. She raced ahead to catch the golfers. Hanover was going to tee off again. There was water on the next hole. If only that stupid official would let up. Are we sure about this? Asked Lucy Pendle.
90%, said her cameraman, Alf Redding.
Alf usually worked with Jason Bernard and was surprised when he found out that Jason would not be working the marathon and he would be working with Lucy. Lucy was okay, but not a great sportscaster. But more and more women were breaking into the field, and experience was the best teacher. She was actually interested in listening to his tips and suggestions. How could this happen? All that footage with the family and coaches, unusable, she fumed.
It happens, Elf said.
They had spent nearly an hour tracking down Eric Gunther's family and friends in the crowd, getting reactions and commentary on how Eric was doing, and about his dream of running a whole marathon before his 17th birthday. Now the miserable kid was on his way to the hospital with a drug overdose. Lucy was doomed to interviews with foreign-speaking African runners who had dominated the American marathons for years. She'd be lucky to get 10 seconds of usable video from them. The Gunther story would play, but if only he had won. The race, as far as the major competitors were concerned, would be over in an hour. She now dreaded having to cover the Gunther story. Nobody liked a cheater, even if it was newsworthy. Most people would be angry with the kid for what he pulled, not sympathetic. Lucy wanted no part of the whole situation.
Let's get some shots of people who are walking. You know, why are you doing this? What do you hope to prove? That sort of stuff.
Gotcha, Chief, agreed Alf amiably.
He hoped Jason was having more fun than he was. He doubted it. Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.